We've been looking at the past couple of weeks. We looked at Sunday. We really started looking at the genealogy, the family really of Jesus, Mary presenting Jesus unto God by the sacrifice, Jesus going down, Joseph taking Mary and Jesus down into Egypt, and then where it was that Jesus grew up. So we're going to look a little bit deeper tonight into the genealogy, some of the things that we see there, and look and see what it is and what really these things have to do with us. Why are they there for us? We've kind of hinted at that. We've answered a couple of questions concerning that, but we're going to look a little bit deeper at it tonight. So let's turn to Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. Now in Matthew chapter 1, we go back to Abraham. I believe in Luke chapter 3, it takes it all the way back to Adam. You see these two genealogies. You lay them side by side. Many of the names match. Some of them don't. Some of the names that you see in Luke are just other names for the same people. Some of the names are different because they are different people. And the reason for that is, as we talked about when we first started talking about the genealogy, is that Matthew is the lineage of Joseph and his side. Because it would be his side, really, that would be used to be traced all the way back to the throne of David. Okay, from the father's side. And that being, of course, Jesus' earthly father. In Luke, at a certain point, it kind of splits off from having the same names there because that is the genealogy, from Mary's side. But what we find is that, both with Joseph and with Mary, both of them trace back to the throne of David. And so he is the rightful heir to the throne of David from both sides. Okay? And so, that's why you have those differences there. And as we talked about the difference in Matthew and Luke is that Matthew was written to whom? To the Jews. Luke was written to the Greeks. Okay? And so there's a different appeal, with these genealogies and who they're, targeting. There. We talked about the women, we talked to them at length on Sunday, so we're not going to get very, far into them. But some things that we didn't get to, I want us to look at, but we'll go through, here. Let's start down in verse 6 with David and go through the rest of the genealogy here. Jesse begat David the king, and David the king begat Solomon of her that had, been the wife of Uriah. And Solomon begat Rehoboam begat Abiah, and Abiah begat Asa, and Asa begat Josaphat, and Josaphat begat Joram. Joram begat Ozias, and Ozias begat Jotham, and Jotham begat Achaz, and Achaz begat Ezekias. Ezekias begat Manasseh, Manasseh begat Ammon, and Ammon begat Josias. And Josias begat Jeconias and his brethren about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconias begat Salathiel, Salathiel begat Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel begat Abiah, Abiah begat Eliakim, Eliakim begat Azor, Azor begat Sadok, Sadok begat Achim, Achim begat Eliad, Eliad begat Eleazar, Eleazar begat Matthan, Matthan begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. And then verse 17 tells us, from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David until the Babylonian captivity are 14 generations. And from the captivity to Jesus are 14 generations. And this is how the Jews break it down a lot of times. Okay? Is you have you've got this even set. And so you've got three even sets of 14 with the coming here of Christ. Now what I want us to look at, and there are many, and as we've talked about, there are many reasons for the genealogy. Now, we understand that Matthew, written to the Jews, Luke, written to the Greeks. So what use do you and I have of the genealogies today? Okay? What about the throne of David? Okay? What is the throne of David? What is that terminology? What does that have to do with, anyway? Alright, with David being king, obviously. Okay, what else? When we talk about the throne of David, what are we talking about? Okay, with David in particular, talking about a man after God's own heart. Okay. Go back to what Jerry said a moment ago about literally and figuratively. Okay? Literally, the throne of David refers to what kingdom? Judah. Kingdom of Israel. Okay? Back during the time, that was, under David's rule, was Israel united or divided? United. Okay? So we're talking about Israel as a whole. Right? So the throne of David, we're talking about the physical, literal kingdom of David or of Israel, under his rule. On the figurative side of it, or the, probably the way I would look at it, as Rick and I were talking about some other things, today, shadows to come or types and anti-types. Okay? So over here you got the literal, but it's this literal throne of David is also a shadow of what? Christ. Okay? And his kingship. Okay? So if David's throne, the throne of David, literally refers to the kingdom of Israel, what does it refer to as far as a type and shadow, or type and antitype or shadow of things to come? The kingdom of heaven, the church. Same deal, right? Kingdom of heaven and the church are the same thing, right? Alright, so we've got, this is what we're talking about here. Now, something else going along with the throne of David. Let's look at, let's go down to verses 11 and 12. Josias begat Jeconias. Alright, how else is this man referred to? Jeconias. Jeconiah. What else? Coniah. Okay. Two or three different names he's called by. Coniah, seems to be the most commonly used, concerning him. Alright. What is said about Coniah or Jeconiah as they're carried away to Babylon? Alright, let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah chapter 22. You want to see how you can use the genealogy to teach the truth and combat falsehood? This is it right here. Okay? Was Jeconiah a direct descendant of David? Was Jeconiah a king of Judah? Yes. Okay, and we talked about, last quarter, we talked about the kingdoms. How many dynasties in the Northern Kingdom? Yes. Dynasties? Different families. It was about 13. Or nine. It was nine. Nine different dynasties. And one, all coming through the seed line of David in the southern. Okay? Jeconiah was one of those. Okay? Coniah was one of those. He was one of the throne, he was one of the seed line of David, and he was the rightful ruler of the throne. Okay? As he is carried, as he was not a very good king, and during his lifetime it was that Babylon came and carried them away to captivity, and because he was not a very good king, Jeremiah says, someone read verse 30 for us. Jeremiah 22 and verse 30. Notice what God says here. Now remember, as we're reading these prophets, and as we've talked about before, when the prophets are writing, whose words are these? Are they God's or are these words Jeremiah's? They're God's words. Now what does God say concerning Jeconiah? Okay. So if we stop right there, after that first phrase, write ye this man childless, we're automatically thinking he's either going to have no children or his children are going to be killed. Right? Were some of his children killed? What happened to Jeconiah? What did they do to him? Mm-hmm. But what did they do before that? They killed his sons. Okay? They had, and the picture, a lot of times that you may see on the History Channel or in the Hollywood portrayals of such thing. Now, they don't, to my knowledge, there's nothing on the History Channel or in Hollywood having to do with Jeconiah specifically. But what happened a lot of times when people would go in and they would conquer a city-state who had a king or a country that had a king such as Judah was they would kill their sons. And sometimes, as is the case of Jeconiah, what Babylon did to him was they would have had him in chains. He would have been on his knees, and he would have been forced to watch them first torture his sons, and then kill his sons before his eyes. And then as soon as their throats are slit or whatever they do to them, they put his eyes out. So the last memory that he's ever going to have as far as what he sees is of his sons being killed before his very eyes. Okay? So if we stop there, that's what we get, is that his children are killed or he has no children, right? But we continue to read and we understand that when it says, write ye this man childless, we're not talking about literally he has no children or all of his children have been killed. Okay? He goes into, you go on and read Matthew, the next verse, and verse 12, after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconias begat Salathiel, and Salathiel begat Zerubbabel. Okay, so before the captivity, or as they're going into captivity, his sons are slain. But after he gets into captivity, he has other sons. Okay, and so the seed line continues. Now, his seed line, because of who he is in the seed line of David, his seed line would be the rightful heir to the physical throne if it were ever to be restored. Okay? But we know that it was never to be restored. Was Israel looking for a physical restoration of their king, of their kingdom? Judah, yes, they were. Okay? They very much wanted one, and they very much sought after that. You even look at Peter's mother. And Andrew's mother. What did she want of Jesus when he ascended to the throne, as she was thinking and as Peter and Andrew were thinking? Okay. Jesus, when you're king, I want my sons to be your chief advisors. That was her thought. And Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. And that's what he's going to say the same thing to Peter later on. You don't know what you're asking. And that type of thing. Okay, so here you have Jeconiah or Coniah. He's written childless, and we go on and read. Somebody read the end of verse 30 again. All right, it looks like all of Israel forgot to read Jeremiah 22 and verse 30. If God has told me that nobody of the seed line of David is ever going to sit upon that throne and prosper anymore, why would I want them upon the throne? How many of you here would like to live in a third world country? You have no idea what the electricity is going to do from day to day or even from second to second. You don't have clean water. This is talking about, if another of the seed line of David comes to rule, they might have a kingdom, but what kind of kingdom is it going to be? It's not going to be one of God. It's going to be corrupt. It's going to be bankrupt. It's not going to be a good one. No man of David is ever going to sit up on that throne again and prosper. Okay? Did one of these sons of Jeconiah ever sit upon the throne? As far as maybe being a puppet king? Zerubbabel, okay, was placed back here in Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. How'd that work out? You remember Zerubbabel tried to rebel. What happened to him? Same thing happened to him that happened to his grandfather, right? It wasn't a pretty sight. Okay? He comes back, Zerubbabel's taken out, and somebody else finally is placed in that, and somebody not of the seed today is placed in that. But in any case, Zerubbabel, he was a puppet king. Okay? He wasn't a king in the true sense of the word. Okay? So, if you want, and why are we talking about this, by the way? Why talk about Jeconiah and the seed line of David and his seed being him being written childless and not prospering upon the throne of David? Why are we talking about that? Okay. People are enthralled with the end times. What we're talking about, friends, is premillennialism. Okay? The idea that Israel is one day going to be restored to her homeland as they see it, because according to premillennialism, God's land promise was never completely fulfilled. Okay, and so what's going to happen is Israel's going to go back over there. They're going to completely reign over the land of Canaan. By the way, you go and look, and even during the time of Joshua, what is said of God's land promise? It was fulfilled. They already had it. They gained more land under Saul, even more land under David, and by the time Solomon got to rule, they pretty much ruled from Persia to the east, all the way down to Egypt to the south, all the way up to the very edge of Greece to the north and to the west. Okay? That is a very large area. Now, Solomon didn't accomplish that as his father David had done. As Rick pointed out with Solomon, a lot of his marriages were diplomatic. Okay? This was strategy, political strategy on his part, and how he gained all that land. But in any case, did God fulfill and completely fulfill the land promise? Yes. Okay, but we look at this genealogy and we go back and we look at the history, go back to the Old Testament, Jeremiah 22 and verse 30 being one. And what do we see with, you can defeat premillennialism with the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1. And it's all around us. Just about every denomination or someone of every denomination that you talk to, they're going to believe in some form, it seems, of premillennialism, they're going to believe in some form of Calvinism. And by the way, you can defeat Calvinism with those women that we talked about, okay, last week or this past Sunday. And that's just with the genealogy. You hadn't even gotten past the first 17 verses of Matthew chapter 1 yet, and you're already defending the truth and defeating false doctrine. And that's just with the first 17 verses of the New Testament. False hope. And that's what it gives them, false hope. Premillennialism is an entirely materialistic doctrine. It's all about what God gives me rather than what I can do in service to God. Okay? Absolutely. Right. Right. Absolutely. Right. Right. I mean, premillennialism, it's false on so many levels, okay? You don't read of the rapture any form or fashion within the pages of the Bible. As a matter of fact, I don't even think the word is used in the New Testament. It's not translated right there. But I don't think it's used at all. The Vulgate, okay, yeah, and even with the word not being mentioned, the doctrine is nowhere in the pages of the New Testament. It's completely fabricated. And again, it has to do. They're looking at something physical, where God is talking about the spiritual. They're doing with premillennialism. They're doing the same thing the Jews were when Jesus came. They're looking for a physical king. And Jesus said there's not going to be a physical king. The Bible tells us that. Right. Like we need to protect Israel because of what the Bible, there's nothing there. I don't think that guy's in the majority. I think the majority believe there are going to be a second chance. Right. Listen, that's denominationalism anyway. I've told the story before, while my first work in Alabama. We had several, members there at Lineville whose family members were, diehard Baptists. And you had a First Baptist church on the north end of town, you had a First Baptist church on the south end of town. And we're talking about a town of 3,000 max. I could be from the north end of town to the south end of town in 5 minutes, and you've got two different First Baptist Church, okay? In August, I went to a funeral at the one on the north end of town, and they had their, up on the front up here where we have our register and our hymns up here, on the left side, they had, their articles of confession, or whatever they called it, okay? And there were 10 articles. And I don't remember what they were off the top of my head, but I do remember this, and August, September, the next month, so like 3-4 weeks later, I go to the one on the south end of town for a funeral. And I'm up there, and they've got the same type of deal. Up on the left side, up at the front of the auditorium, they have their articles of confession. And there were at least three on the south end of town that completely contradicted what they had on their wall at the north end of town. And they both wear the same name. So that's just denominationalism. You'll have this one over here teaching this about premillennialism, this one over here teaching this about premillennialism, and they don't mesh. Everybody has their own version. And it's the same deal with Calvinism. You have several denominations that will adhere to the TUL of TULIP, but we don't adhere to the IP, not realizing that all five, if you believe in one, you have to believe in all five, because they all go together. But it is. It's very confusing, and God is not the author of confusion. Okay? Right. Right. Now, that, you know, and that's why I wanted to look at it with just the genealogy. Because you can just, like I said, the first 17 verses of Matthew, you're already defeating two major tenets of denominationalism. Completely defeating premillennialism, you're already completely defeating Calvinism, just here within the first 17 verses of the New Testament. So that's what I want to look at there. But I also wanted to look, as it is getting close to Christmas, I want us to turn over to the book of Luke. Book of Luke. Okay, let's look at Luke chapter 2 for a moment. Friends, here's where your Bible geography comes in handy. Okay, and knowing the seasons of the time on that side of the world as well as here and putting things together. Okay, this is a time of year we refer to as Christmas. Okay, and it's a universal term talking about this particular time of year, this holiday. Now, I'm sure I don't have to go into the history of Christmas and how it came about or that type of thing. Listen, I celebrate Christmas as a time to be with family, as a time to spend with my family, to see folks I haven't seen in a while. You know, I take that time to be able to spend with them. I do not celebrate it as the time of Christ's birth simply because I don't have the proof that, number one, we ought to celebrate his birth. Am I thankful that Jesus was born? Absolutely, because if he wasn't born, he couldn't die for my sins. Okay? We are told to not celebrate, but to commemorate his death upon the cross every first day of the week. And we do that with the Lord's Supper. Now, with all that said, I want us to look at Luke chapter 2, and I want us to begin in verse 8. And I want us to notice something that's taking place here, and let's make some deductions from this, okay? Let's look at Luke chapter 2, and let's begin in verse 8. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord, and this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all things that they had heard and seen, and as it was told unto them. All right, where do we find the shepherds in this passage? Where are they? In the hills, in the field. Okay, let's reconcile this for a moment. How is it typically, in most other places except for Texas and in the tropicals, in the month of December around the 25th? It's cold. Okay? It's cold. And friends, it's going to be the same. Where is Bethlehem located, by the way? All right, in the hills of Judea, just south of Jerusalem. Okay? Now, if you were to look at a map, at a world map, you're going to see that this is quite a bit north, north of the equator. And so, even as we are now in our time of winter, what are they over there? They're more in the winter, okay? They may not be as cold over there, but what we need to know is this is now, they may not get the type of snow and things that we get over here in the United States, but what they do get is a lot of rain. Okay? A lot of rain. And what would happen is the shepherds would keep their flocks in the field until the first rain fell. And when that first rain fell, they would bring their sheep home and put them in the fold. Now what do we mean by putting them in the fold? Put them in the pen, right? And they keep them fed there during the winter. Also, they're huddled together there. It keeps them warm, keeps them away from the wolves and things. And so you don't have, there's no reason if this is actually in the month of December, why are the shepherds in the field? They're not out there looking for lost sheep. What are they doing over their sheep? They're watching them at night. Okay? They're protecting them from the predators. If Jesus was actually born in December, around the 25th of December, why are the shepherds in the field? They wouldn't be. They would have their sheep already at home in the fold. And so, you know, we look at this and you just examine all the evidence, okay? The best we can tell. Now, obviously, in Scripture, are we given a date of Jesus' birth? Why do you suppose that is? What do men do with those type of things? They worship those things. Then in reality, what we're seeing happening with this time of Christmas and what we're seeing happening with December 25th, and the reason I know this is happening, what do you suppose, and I hate to say it, but it's going to be the same case here. Okay? What do you suppose is going to happen on this Sunday or maybe even Wednesday closest to Christmas? To attendance? Alright, some of them worship services will be canceled, but with the, most especially if it falls on the 20th, what do you say with attendance? Why is that? Because it's Christmas. The idea, of course, that is being put forward is we're worshiping Jesus, we're worshiping God at this time. But what they're doing is worshiping a date. Because a lot of those same people that won't go to church, that won't go to worship any other time during the year, will go on the 25th. They're not worshiping God. Because God isn't important enough to worship the rest of the year, but we're going to worship on this date. And so what we've done is we've taken this date and placed it above all others. Doesn't Paul say he's afraid of that type of thing? Does, doesn't he? Because you keep times and months and days and years. Yes, ma'am. Ma'am? Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh. Right. And so you've got, you know, when we look at all the evidence, okay, we examine every bit of it. The best that we can tell, Jesus is going to be born sometime between the time of March and June. Okay, he's going to be born in basically in the spring to early summer is when he's going to be born. Okay, from Luke chapter 2 and some of the other evidence that we can look at, that's what we're seeing. You know, they're in the, and not only that, but you can go and look at the time of taxation, under Augustus. And that matches up with the spring. That's when they would go, and be taxed in their home, the city of their fathers, would be in the springtime under Augustus. And so that all matches up. And so, you know, it's needful for us to examine, all of this evidence. Let's see. We talked a little bit, at the end of Luke chapter 2 about Mary and her presenting Jesus, unto God. What did they sacrifice? Turtle doves. Why turtle doves? Why pigeons? Okay, that's what the poor were able to offer. Right? You go back to the old law. You go back to the law of Moses. All right, and the all of the firstborn sons, all the firstborn males, who'd they belong to? Belong unto God. Now, obviously, you're not going to sacrifice your firstborn son. God's not going to call upon you to murder your firstborn son. So what have you got to do? You have to dedicate him or redeem him. Okay? In order to redeem him, you have to give up something, right? That's the whole idea of something being redeemed. Correct? We talk about Jesus being our redeemer. Well, what did he redeem us from? Sin. Took us from hell. Okay? Because what? He paid a price. Right? That's the idea. You have to pay a price to redeem something. Correct? Okay. So here's this idea. And so you're not going to murder your firstborn son, so you have to redeem him. So under the old law, what did you have to sacrifice? Okay, you had to sacrifice a lamb or a bullock, okay? Or if you were very poor and you didn't have a lamb, you didn't have a bullock, you didn't have a goat, what did you sacrifice? You went to the market and you paid a couple of pence a piece or a couple of pence for a couple of doves, a couple of pigeons. And then you would take them to the altar to be sacrificed to redeem your child. And so what do we learn, as we talked about Sunday, what do we learn of Mary and Joseph's economic and social status from this? Up here or down here? Way down here, right? Okay. Right. Good point. Go back to Malachi, right? They were offering the sick and the lame in Malachi. Malachi says you wouldn't offer that to your governor, and you expect God to accept it. That's a great point. All right, how do we know that Joseph and Mary were righteous? What do we know about them? All right, she was chosen to be the mother of God. Okay, the mother of God in the flesh. She was chosen to be the mother of Jesus. Why would Jesus, or why would God choose someone that was corrupt and immoral and deceptive? Okay? And then Joseph, what do we learn about Joseph and his dealings with Mary when he finds out she's pregnant? Put his reputation on the line on top of everything else, didn't he? And, so, no matter. What's that? Right, an angel, okay? You don't want to dispute the word of an angel on top of that, so. Right. Good point. So that's what we know about Mary and Joseph. And here, you know, they offer this. So we learn a little bit about their social and economic status. Of course, their social status was sealed because where did they live? Where were they from? Nazareth. And what is said of Nazareth? Nothing good comes out of Nazareth, right? So they're not going to be socially, accepted, you know, in the world at large. And then on top of that, you've got the whole deal with Mary being with child before her marriage is consummated. And we talked a little bit about that on Sunday. Yes, sir. Mainly because it was poor. Just like, you know, in any major city that you go to today, and you go into the ghetto, the people that live in affluent areas of a certain city, how do they look at the ghetto? It was. Listen, you go into Nazareth, okay, and this is just the picture that you get. It's going to be, you're going into the slums, is kind of what you're looking at, okay? And so it's not going to be a very good area. You know, everything, it seems, that is associated with Nazareth, people don't want anything to do with it. And that's just how it's looked at. Right, geographically it was. Right. Well, listen, you look at everything associated with Christmas, okay? Well, right, and that's what I'm getting at. Everything that's associated with Christmas, everything, okay? How many of you have a Christmas tree up in your house? Okay, I do too. You know where that comes from? It's not Christian. It's pagan. Okay? They would worship, that tree became an idol. Alright? The Yuletide log had to do with the God of Thunder, had to do with Thor. The ornaments on your tree, that's part of the worship to that idol that you're making that tree into. And that's all, there's not, listen, I've got a Christmas tree, I've got ornaments on it. Okay? But I'm not worshiping any pagan god. Okay? But this is where these things came from. What happened was the Catholic Church, by and large, had its own army. Okay? They would go in, they would conquer an area. You ever heard of the Holy Roman Empire? Okay? This is a totally separate empire from the Roman Empire. Okay? This is the Catholic Church going in and conquering an area. And what would happen, as Rick and I were talking today, we're talking about this very same thing, okay? They would go into an area and they would conquer a people, but they couldn't conquer their hearts. Okay? They would still worship their own gods and such. But now they would still, in motion and in outward appearance, they would worship as the church wanted them to worship. Okay? But we get out of midnight mass and we're going over here to worship Thor. Okay, is what they would do. They would do both. And so in order to, I guess as they saw it, help, their people along, was, you know, well, they're already worshiping the sun god during this time. They already have a celebration to Thor during this time. They already have all of this going on. So what we'll do is we'll say this is Jesus' birthday and we'll have the celebration and we'll wrap it all up in one neat package. And we give it to these pagan people so they get to do the same things, but instead of worshiping Thor, instead of worshiping their own gods, they worship ours. At least in appearance, as they put it, okay? And so this is where all of our Christmas celebrations come from. And all of these different traditions. Yes, sir? It is. It still is a national holiday. Yeah, absolutely. That's good. That's a great point. Jack? Oh yeah, you go back and look at the Crusades, man, and that's a rough time. All right, great discussion, guys. We'll get if you want to look ahead. We're going to be talking a lot about John the Baptist and his parents on Sunday. Now we won't have class next Wednesday. It's Christmas Eve. We'll have kind of a singing and devotional period, but we're going to look Sunday. We're going to look at John the Baptist and his parents and the prophecy concerning him.